Terrific, Silly Sidney, Monroe, Samson, Scrap, and Delilah, Tom and Jerry, and countless others. It can only be one guy, a legend. Gene Deitch, next.
Hey, kid, you want a toy?
Uh-huh.
How about a bike?
No.
A video game?
No!
Well, okay. You pick a toy. Yes, log. All kids love log.
One rolls downstairs, a motor in pairs, rolls over your neighbor's dog. What's great for a snack and fits on your back, it's log, log, log. It's log, log, it's big, it's heavy, it's wood. It's log, log, it's better than that, it's good. Everyone wants a log, you're gonna love it, log. Come on and get your log.
Log from Blammo.
When you've got a job to do, reach for something good to chew. Chewing helps you stand the pace, anytime and any place. So, hi-ho, hey-hey, chew your little troubles away. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. Work goes faster, smoother too. Life seems brighter when you chew. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. It's good to sink your teeth into Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. That lively flavor freshens your mouth, and the good chewing helps make the job go smoother and faster. Enjoy chewing Wrigley's Spearmint Gum every day, as millions do. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew your little troubles away. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum.
Often that one happens upon a chance interview with who many in the animation industry would regard to as a legend, but I was afforded such an opportunity this past weekend, and I wasn't about to miss this chance of a lifetime. Gene Deitch is truly a one-of-a-kind animator, creator, director, and individual. He's not afraid to give his views, and if one listens to him carefully, one can learn a lot about patience, persistence, and life. To start out this hour-long interview, I asked Gene to take us back to his childhood and to his treasured days with his Kim projector.
Well, my very first projector was one I made myself, actually, out of a shoebox. I could only project still drawings with it, but a clever toy I got for Christmas in 1932 when I was about 8 years old was the alternating two-lens Kim projector, also marketed as a NIC projector. NIC. It was the first thing I had that could really project a motion effect. It was one of those crackle-painted tin toys from the early 1930s that projected a light through a wide strip of onion skin paper that you spooled through it. As the paper moved, an internal shutter would alternate between the upper and lower lenses. So if you had a drawing on the upper half of the paper strip and of a character in one position and in a different position on the lower half, the shutter would allow the drawings to be alternately projected on the screen, a bed sheet or whatever you had hanging on the wall, so that when you turned the crank, the character would not only move across the screen, but would rapidly alternate positions, like the legs would be opening and closing, simulating a walk. It was basic primitive animation. I loved this simple toy projector because even though it came with rolls of Popeye or Mickey Mouse animated series printed on translucent paper, it was the blank rolls that interested me because they allowed me to draw and project my very first animation. Because there was a decal on the side of this projector that had a picture of Rudyard Kipling's boy hero Kim, I called it my Kim projector. Many years later, when my first son was born, I named him Kim. Today, he's a famous cartoonist, and I believe the only person in the world to be named after a toy movie projector. Paul Parrott was my first animation actually photographed on movie film. He was the hero of a short cartoon movie I made as an art class project in junior high school in Venice, California, when I was 13 years old. Paul was supposed to be an astronaut who rocketed to the moon, and my hilarious gag was that when the Parrott character landed on the moon, that there was a big sign stuck on it that said Los Angeles City Limits.
That's great. That is excellent. Were your parents very supportive of, you know, your hobby, and were they really supportive of the arts and all that when you were?
Yeah, well, my mother was especially supportive because she herself was a frustrated movie personality or actress. She wanted to be either an actress, a dancer, or something professional. She was taking acting lessons all the time. Of course, nothing ever came of it. But living in Hollywood, it was one of those things where parents were always pushing their kids to be successful in something to do with the entertainment industry. So she was very supportive. My father was a salesman, and he poo-pooed the whole idea, and he figured I wouldn't ever amount to anything as an artist.
Okay. Well, so, yeah, it shows how wrong he was. Well, it'd be easy. It's easy to get. I mean, really. I'm going to the second question here, and it's really easy to get lost. And your professional history is diverse and vast as it is. But I'd like to focus, if I could, on a couple of like your pivotal moments early in your career that you believe may have been like the catalyst to setting your animation career in motion. And personally, I'm not a huge believer in luck, but I do believe in being prepared for the right opportunity should it arise. And so, going to your cartoons and graphics that you were doing in the mid-40s for the, it was I guess you'd say, an obscure jazz magazine called The Record Changer. Mm-hmm. As unlikely as it may seem, that actually helped you in your entrance into the animation world. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, well, I think you've stated it perfectly in your question, Todd. Luck exists in the form of chance happenings. The trick is to recognize your chances, to be prepared for them, as you just said, and to move quickly to seize the opportunities when they arise. I can attest that I've had a great deal of luck, both good and bad, as everyone has. Some, as you allude to, amazingly showed how seemingly unrelated incidents can come together. I always dreamed of being an animator since I was 8 years old with my toy Kim projector, but the chance seemed to be really out of the question. When I was discharged from the Army, just as World War II was winding down in 1944, I was already married. Our son Kim was born on the very day I was discharged. So married and with a kid at the age of just 20, I emerged from the Army with family responsibilities right out of the box. I couldn't afford to fool around with impossible dreams. So I got a low-paying job as a staff artist in a tiny Los Angeles advertising agency named the Tullis Company, run on a tight budget by a guy named Howard Tullis. I learned how to paint ice cream for his prime client, Franilla, but I couldn't support my new family on the miserable salary he was paying me. Then there was I got a tremendous lucky break. I landed a dream job as an assistant to the art director of CBS Radio in Hollywood. I was walking down Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood on my way home, brooding over my situation, and I glanced up at this hyper-modern building of CBS Radio. I learned later that this was a landmark of architecture by William Lescazze, really classy among the usual kitschy Hollywood landscape. That's where I'd like to work. I thought, you know, they must have an art department in there, I thought. And so then I took a wild chance. Even then, you know, you just couldn't walk into a radio station. You certainly couldn't do it today. But I had my portfolio of drawings under my arm, so I just took a deep breath and I strode right in as if I was in a hurry to make an appointment or something. I didn't look to the right or left. I headed right for the bank of elevators. I needed to quickly get off the first floor before I was spotted. I got off at a random higher floor, and I asked the rushing radio worker which way was it to the art department, assuming there was an art department. It was, of course, on a different floor, but no matter, I got to it, and cold turkey introduced myself to the art director, a quizzical, mustachioed gentleman named Jim Cantwell. He was amused at my gate crashing. He liked my drawings, but what sold him on me was the news that I was married and had a small kid. To him, that meant that I would be steady and reliable, and I was hired. Now, if you go to Wikipedia and you look up CBS Radio Hollywood, you can see the full-size photo of that great building just as I saw it in 1944. Working in that classic company, such a classic company as CBS, was a tremendous break for a young graphic artist. I was doing well there, proud of being so quickly able to support my little family and learn craft of high-style graphic design and typography. CBS at that time had set the standard for graphic art in America, as set down by CBS New York headquarters by the master art director William Golden. So I was learning graphic design from the best. There was still no broadcast television in 1944, as TV was to come along just about a year or so later. I had a great career lined up, but it was still just another form of advertising, promotional mailers and the like. There were dominant animation bugs in my bonnet continuously, dreams of doing art that would be directly communicating with the public, such as newspaper comic strip or magazine cartoons. And here's where a lot of streams began to converge in Career River. I was also a feverish traditional jazz fan. My passion for collecting 78 RPM old shellac records led me to the Jazzman Record Shop in Hollywood. There, beside the fabulous stock of real jazz records, I noticed a magazine lying on their counter. It was a simply printed periodic, mainly made up of classified ads from collectors wanting to buy, sell, and trade the rare old traditional jazz and blues records. It had a catchy double-meaning title, The Record Changer. You have to remember that in those days, there were those heavy, black, brittle 78 RPM shellac records, each of which played 30 minutes on a side. So machines were developed then in which you could load a stack of those records, and it would automatically change the discs as each one finished playing. So a magazine that exchanged records was cleverly titled The Record Changer. There were also a few articles by various critics and collectors, but no illustrations. Here was my chance for personal publication. I quickly dashed off a few cartoons featuring a bespectacled fanatic jazz record collector such as I was and sent them in. The magazine was published all the way across the country in Fairfax, Virginia. It was a suburb of Washington, D.C. I was still in Hollywood. The editor, Gordon Gullickson, immediately accepted my cartoons and named my character the Cat. That's what Louis Armstrong used to call his fellow musicians as well as his fans. What was good enough for Louis was good enough for Gordon, so my character became the Cat and a regular feature in the magazine for nearly 10 years. I not only did two or three cat cartoons for each issue, but also began doing covers and eventually became the art director of The Changer. And that led to my second great chance event. As I was also an eager collector, I followed the ads on each issue myself. And in one, I saw a Jelly Roll Morton record, I think it was called Sidewalk Blues, offered that I had been searching for. And amazingly, the seller happened to live just a few blocks from our Hollywood bungalow. The man who opened the door was William Bernal, and the minute he heard my name, he told me that some genius animators were readers of the Record Changer and fans of my cat cartoons and cover designs. He was referring to the new hot animation studio UPA, destined, of course, to make animation history. What an amazing break that was. I would never have had a chance in hell with no animation studio experience whatever to break into this magic group. But now I heard that they were inviting me in. But wait, there's still another chance miracle coming up. It turned out that as much as UPA wanted to have a fresh young talent who was unsullied by having worked in one of the old the cornball traditional animation studios, the rules of the Hollywood Animators Union would not allow it. Animation jobs were scarce, and contract studios were only allowed to hire union members. The catch-22 went even further. I could not become a member of the union unless I already worked for one of the contract studios. Then came the third miracle. Exactly at that moment, the chief production designer of UPA, Bill Hertz, was the president of the union. He wanted me as his assistant, and he was able to push through an exception based on the premise that I was an exceptional talent that could not be found among union members, started in the standard studio style, blah, 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 and I got in. And from that moment to this day, 63 years later, I've never been out of work in animation. Now, what was that, luck or what?
That's an amazing story. I just can't get over that. It is luck, Gene, but it's luck. I mean, you had the talent, so, you know what I mean, you could seize the opportunities, call them luck or whatever, when they came, you know?
Well, that, of course, is the big secret. You've got to be ready for the opportunity. You just said that yourself before.
Yeah.
But the opportunities do come. Of course, I was vibrating with joy and fulfillment, of course, being in the same studio with such pioneering geniuses as John Hubley, Art Babbitt, Bob Cannon, Jules Engels, and so many others there. But also very nervous because I'd given up my steady and prestigious job for CBS with its promising future for work with a ragtag group perpetually on the brink of bankruptcy.
That's, you know, and really looking back at your style with the Record Changer, your graphic style, your art style, it really looked like a perfect transition to go to this new, so-called new style that UPA was doing with their animation as opposed to the standard house styles of Disney, MGM, and Warner's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, well, it just happened to work out that way because one of the things that was basic about UPA was that they had given up the idea of an animation house style. In other words, if you worked for Disney, you had to be able to draw Mickey Mouse, and if you worked for Warner's, you had to be able to draw Bugs Bunny, and at MGM, you had to draw Tom and Jerry. UPA had a completely different concept, the idea being that each story should have its own style of art that was correct for that particular story. And they drew on the greatest designers, painters, and illustrators of the time. That was the number one achievement of UPA.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, you have a wonderful online book called How to Succeed in Animation. And you describe in that book, and I'll at the end of this, I'll have a web address or you can mention whatever for mm-hmm. people can go to look, because I think it's that important. But you describe the process of learning almost anything and not being intimidated by something new. Basically, step by step, you're saying with basic talent and skill and observation, any intelligent person can figure out how to do any job. This seemed to work for you with the next job you had at JHO. Can you explain how that opportunity...
Yeah, well, that was it. Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, you never can say to anyone that you can't do anything. If you're an intelligent person, you have the basic talent, and you can analyze the work and figure out how to do it, you can somehow manage. And you've just stated my basic philosophy and approach to any undertaking. You have to have a well-thought-out plan, figure out what has to be done first, second, and third, and always keep your goal in mind. Now, I almost goofed it in my first interview at Jam Handy. I told the chiefs there that I wasn't really an animator. I was proud that I had become a journeyman UPA production designer. This was a special title at UPA, which was considered to be a notch above an animator. But those jam handy guys had just laid out train fare to haul me all the way from Hollywood to Detroit on the assumption that I was a hot young star animator. I had to do a lot of fancy backpedaling to make it through that interview. I pointed out to them that the term animator was really generic for anyone who worked in an animation studio, blah, blah, blah. But that didn't exactly convince them. So the first thing they did was give me a job to animate an important TV commercial. And I had actually never before professionally animated a single scene. I had snooped around at UPA, watched how they did it. I'd studied some animation on Moviola, etc. But I had never actually done it. So I took this commercial and I just did a step-by-step analysis of the problem. After all, I could draw, and luckily the standard of animation at Jam Handy was low. Well, when I finished it, they thought that my UPA-influenced animation was the greatest thing they ever saw. I was in. And incredibly, soon after that, they made me a director, and a short time later, I was actually named chief of the JHO Animation Department. So luck was with me again.
That's amazing. That's you did some tap dancing and backpedaling, but you got around it. But that's a great lesson to learn. I mean, it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, I don't think, are aware that you'd also been producing a cute, well, I said cute, see, an entertaining comic strip. My wife thought it was cute, okay? So you did this on your own time called Terrible Thompson, and while you were working at UPA or a little before maybe, but tell us how you came up with that, if you would, and then what prompted you to do that, and then why you decided to drop it or why you felt you had to drop it.
Well, no offense against your wife, but of course, the word cute was one that was sort of an anathema at UPA. You know, we wanted to have drawings meaningful. And as far as my comic strip was concerned, naturally, I hoped it was funny, charming, thought-provoking, graphically new at the time, and of course, entertaining. At least that was my aim for it. I started working on the idea of a 7.5-year-old boy being secretly the actual hero of history while I was still at UPA in Hollywood as early as 1946. It was always going to be called Terrible Thompson, but I realize now that it should have been named something like Awesome Andy. I meant the name Terrible to mean fearsome, not crummy.
Right.
So all the great men and women of history in the strip were shown to be in awe of this little boy. It took a lot of explaining, but otherwise, I'm still proud of my short-lived comic strip. It contained much of my interest in fun with language and absurdity. Having my own nationally syndicated comic strip was another of my intense dreams as a young boy. I devoured the daily newspaper comics when I was a kid, which were, at that time, the major entertainment of the 1930s when I grew up. Seagar's Popeye and Harriman's Crazy Cat were my main influences on the humor and language of Terrible Thompson. I'm delighted now that Fantagraphics Books of Seattle saw fit to restore and publish the entire run of my comic strip in a beautifully produced book.
Yes, and it is. And, you know, I actually came upon Terrible Thompson in another book that preceded that. I believe it was called Art and Time, or The Art and Time, or something like that. It was they had a couple strips from Terrible Thompson. I said, man, this looks like, they reminded me a lot of Tom Terrific. And I saw the name on it, and I said, it's got to be related, you know.
Well,
of course,
that was to come. There was another great thrill connected with Terrible Thompson, even before the comic strip was published. Simon and Schuster's Little Golden Records produced a stunning production of Terrible Thompson with Mitch Miller's orchestra and chorus, and starring the great comic actor Art Carney as the voice of my villain, Mean Morgan. It was, but then a great offer came to me to head the CBS Terrytoons studio, an offer I couldn't possibly refuse. And I had to make the terrible choice to end my strip. I knew the facts. It took a minimum of 5 to 10 years to build a solid comic strip readership and get enough papers to be able to live off of it.
Yeah, hopefully, I mean, with your permission, I'd love to be able to have either a link, because you have a little, you did a little segment on about, a little more detail about that record that was produced there. That would be great, because I know it was really interesting to listen to that. It was really excellent.
But, it was tremendously exciting, because I actually worked up the actual story with my friend Bill Brunell, the one who discovered me for UPA, who later became my closest friend and worked with me on many projects. He was a brilliant writer, and we knew this was something really important, and we made the script, and when I was invited into the studio to watch this being done, it was, for me at that time, was a fantastic experience. You know, there was Mitch Miller's entire orchestra and chorus in there, a whole bunch of actors and sound effect men. You know, in those days they did everything live, more or less. Even though it was recorded, they performed everything at once, because they didn't have, as we have now, the mixing and editing possibilities. So all these sound effect guys were in there, the whole orchestra and everything, and they had a kid who played Terrible Thompson, and I can still hear it today. Unfortunately, by the time they were ready to issue the record, I ended the strip, and so I don't think the record was never actually published, but I did manage to get a what at that time was a disc copy of it. It was, of course, very low quality. Here in Prague, it was restored and put onto my website, so it is possible to hear it now. Probably more people hear it now than it ever would have been heard if it had come out on one of those little yellow records.
Oh, it was entertaining. It was great. It was great. We're only headed to... go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, okay, well, of course, the reason for all this, the reason that it didn't ever go any further, or the commentary didn't go any further, is because I was suddenly approached by an executive from CBS who told me that they had spotted me as the one they wanted to take over Terry Toons from Paul Terry. And this was, again, after all, don't forget, CBS was, I considered my alma mater, you know. This was my ideal company, and I had so enjoyed working with them. And I thought, well, if CBS was going to do it, it could be work out to be something. Because otherwise, Terry Toons was considered by many in our craft as the worst animation studio in the entire world. But when it was suddenly owned by CBS Television, my early employer, it gave me a great chance to create a renaissance there. It was CBS that recruited me and installed me there to take up the challenge. CBS was also the broadcaster of the leading children's show at the time, Captain Kangaroo. Captain Kangaroo needed an animation serial, so it was natural for CBS to have it done in their own wholly owned animation studio, Terry Toons. Ipso facto, it fell to me to produce it. When I received the order to produce something for the Captain Kangaroo show and get it on the air within 6 months, I thought immediately that there was a new chance for at least some of the elements of Terrible Thompson to have a new life. So I dismantled Terrible Thompson as a general audience comic strip and put it back together as Tom Terrific, again TT, this time for very small children. So that's exactly how it came about, saving months of development to try to come up with an entirely new property.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I love the his sidekick, Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. That was one I remember that being my favorite character as a kid. And that was, now, correct me if I'm wrong, that was your design, right? And then Lionel Wilson did the voice for him on the show, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Well, naturally, the project was my concept, and I created the format and all of the elements, and I supervised the writing. I did create Mighty Manfred. I had actually intended to introduce him into the Terrible Thompson comic strip just before I ended it. I personally drew all of the Tom Terrific character model sheets and worked out the technical procedure that could get the maximum out of the minuscule budget. I had a sterling group of writers to do the scripts. The later famous Jules Pfeiffer, Lars Born, Eli Bauer, and the veteran Terry Toon Story Department chief, Tommy Morrison. They were a wonderful group of comedy adventure writers, and we all worked together on the stories and scripts. And, of course, it was my job to insert all the little language gimmicks, which I had taken pretty much from my Terrible Thompson strip. And yes, Lionel Wilson performed absolutely all of the voices for Tom Terrific, for the Tom Terrific serial.
That's great.
He was great. He did he could do anything.
I find it funny, though, a lot of what made Tom Terrific so fun to watch and appealing to me, at least, and I'm sure a lot of people, was actually a result of some cost-cutting decisions you had to make at that time to keep the animation smoother than just plain cutout style. And but of all the cost-cutting measures you had to take, do you feel that the lack of color, using color, was one of those that perhaps, you might look back on with regret?
Yes, I think that, and also I think the lack of color is what keeps it from ever being reissued now. Technically, you could take the old Tom Terrific black and white masters and with the computer hugger mugger we have now, insert color. But no one has ever done that, and there just aren't enough of them, of the episodes, I guess, to make it worthwhile. But my attitude, as you just said, my attitude had to be that if we were forced my attitude was that if we were faced with such a rock bottom, bare bones budget, we should make it appear that we did it this way by choice, inducing children's audience to fill in the gaps with their imagination. And amazingly, that's what really worked for it. The very fact that it was so limited, that it didn't have fully painted background, that it wasn't in color, seemed to leave something for children to put into it on their own. And today, of course, that is what's lacking now, because the technology is so advanced that you can do anything with animation. You can get all kinds of hyper-realism. I mean, look at everything that Pixar can do. There is nothing left to the imagination. The producers of animation now give you everything. And I think it really, in a way, it really worked out to us that if you look at Tom Terrific now, it seems incredibly crude. Yet, because the stories were good and it had real meaning, it didn't seem to matter that it was limited in animation and limited in color.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I have to ask you, this is kind of off the record a little bit. There was I believe it ran for maybe 6 issues, and I meant to ask you this and put this in the questions, Gene, was did you have any involvement with the Tom Terrific comic books?
Yeah, we all of us had fun with that, and we moonlighted on that too. I did 2 or 3 of the comic stories myself in the comic books, and all of the main animators and story guys, or at least many of them, pitched in on it. I know that Connie Rosinski did some, and Lars Born did some, and Eli Bauer did some of the comics, the comic book stuff, and I did too. I did at least 2 or 3 of the stories myself. I happen to have a couple of copies of that, and it was fun to do. But it was really something that all of us on the staff pitched in on, because it was a great promotion for the show.
Yeah.
And those comic books, they have a certain place in history now, I guess.
Yeah, the number one issue, by the way, is very hard to come by. So just so you know. Now you came away with a lesson from Tom Terrific and really about copyrights and your rights to your work with CBS, right? So it's safe to
say.
You go ahead.
This is the reality of our work, and especially in the corporate culture of CBS, anything that was created by a CBS employee belonged to them. I had to sign such an agreement when I took the job. But look, I was so entranced with being a CBS executive and so believed that I would be successful and would be there forever, that it didn't matter to me. I didn't think about that. I banked on Tom Terrific being a success that would accrue to my benefit. It has. I mean, I think it's if you look at Google, look up Tom Terrific on Google, I mean, there are literally thousands of references, and most of them are to the cartoon strip. And I think that it's the one thing I created that went into the language. Tom Terrific is in the language, and when there's an article, even today, if you see an article about Tom Selleck or any other famous person named Tom, they often headline it Tom Terrific. And this was a name I made up, so I've gotten a lot of benefit out of it. But as far as having the rights to it, or for anyone to would be paying me any royalties if they would reissue it or show it, that's zilch. And live and learn. Corporate life is the law of the jungle. even in such rarefied Shangri-La that I thought CBS was.
Yeah. This podcast focuses a lot on funny animal cartoons and art, and ironically, it was a silly animal, and I used the word silly, to allude to your character, Silly Sydney, but that earned you your first Oscar nomination in Terrytoons, nevertheless. So what was that like? Yeah.
Well, Sydney was my nervous wreck elephant. He was spun off from a Tom Terrific episode, as you may know. It didn't have a name, but it had the same voice. It was Lionel Wilson. Sydney turned out to be the most potentially viable character that I created at Terrytoons. The writers there felt much more comfortable with this grotesque animal than with some of my human characters. So we quickly introduced him into our 20th Century Fox CinemaScope theatrical cartoon schedule. The first one was called, actually, 6-6 Sydney, which was sort of a nod to Jules Pfeiffer's original title for his Village Voice cartoon panel that he began while he was still working with me at Terrytoons. But 20th Century Fox didn't like that term, so we renamed him Silly Sydney. The second film was titled Sydney's Family Tree, and that was such a hit that it was actually nominated for an Oscar. I heard that this was the first Oscar nomination in Terrytoons' long history. Well, naturally, I was really delighted, and I felt it would protect me from the hot breath of studio manager Bill Weiss, who was out to get rid of me from my day one there. He was against everything I was doing at Terrytoons. But now we'd won the Oscar nomination, and I hoped that somehow our relationship might lighten up. So I was driving to work in a happy mood after hearing by phone the night before that Silly Sydney's film had been nominated for an Oscar. But I was surprised to find Bill Weiss waiting for me as I drove into the Terrytoons parking lot. He came right up to me before I could even get out of my car. "I want to make one thing clear, Gene," he said. Obviously, he was out there waiting for me so as not to be overheard by anyone inside the studio. "I want to make one thing clear, Gene. If Silly Sydney wins the Oscar, I am going to be the one who goes up on the stage to accept it." Mm. Well, that was clear enough, and it was so absurd that I was all I could do to restrain myself from laughing in his face. What a paranoid and insecure fool he was. He knew he had nothing whatever to do with the creative aspect of Sydney, yet he demanded to be the one to take credit for it. He was spared that embarrassment when Sydney failed to win.
Yeah, that's just that's what a story that is, boy. And I know you could even elaborate a lot on your tenure at Terrytoons, but it seems as though Silly Sydney, though, at a couple of the, I have a DVD of Silly Sydney stuff, and it seemed like there were different voices behind them. But is that true, or was it the same voice actor all the way through for Silly Sydney?
Well, one of the voices was not Bill Weiss. Actually, it started out with Lionel Wilson once again, doing a reprise of what he had done in the Tom Terrific episode, which was a rough imitation of the old vaudeville and early TV comic Ed Wynn. Later, we switched the voice to a bumbling imitation of Hugh Herbert. We were trying one thing after another because we were being constantly nitpicked by 20th Fox. But it was always Lionel Wilson as long as I was there, although it is quite possible that after I left, they did continue the Silly Sydney series without me, and they might have used a different actor, but I can't really comment on that. I don't know.
Now, a lot of the animation for Silly Sydney was created by Jim Tyre, is that true? And was he one of the few bright spots that you discovered as far as the talents at Terrytoons when you took over?
Yeah, Jim Tyre was one-of-a-kind animator, completely original and untamed. I never knew what he was going to do, but it was always funny and often hilarious. He saved many a dull scene. It was amazing that he survived in the monotype gloom of Terrytoons animation, but it was mainly because he could turn out record amounts of footage. That was basically Paul Terry's standard, and that's what kept him there. I love to talk with Jim Tyre. He was a great guy and a unique talent.
There's a wonderful publicity photo I saw when I was reading your online book, How to Succeed in Animation, and it shows that you at the drawing board with your sons Kim and Simon around you. Now, they're making their own marks, as well as your third son, right, in the arts currently?
Yeah, well, that photo was actually a CBS publicity photo made at our Tarrytown, New York home. I lived in Tarrytown and worked for Terry Toon. So
that's funny.
I'm certainly proud to have such three talented sons. Kim is the most widely known, having become one of the pioneer comic novelists of our time. Simon is an excellent artist and idea man, and Seth is a brilliant fantasy novelist. You may know that Seth performed the voice of four-year-old Monroe in our Oscar-winning film, and that he did it when he was only 3 years old.
That's amazing. Now, together with Alan Swift, a New York actor and a voice talent, you created an animation property named Samson, Scrap, and Delilah. Now, this looked to be promising, but then again, it seems to boil down to a rights issue, and as you mentioned before, one opportunity or one missed opportunity, maybe in this case, often leads to another. And Samson, your Samson, as well as Monroe, ultimately leads you to Prague and an Oscar. So
yes, that's right. Everything has a value, even the ones that could be put down as failures. Samson, Scrap, and Delilah hark back to Alan Swift and my childhood. We were relatively poor kids who made our own toys of cast-off junk. In today's world, where nearly all toys are ready made out of plastic and run on batteries, Samson Scrap wouldn't relate to modern kids. Our producer at the time, Bill Snyder, was sure it would be a hit, but he ultimately couldn't sell it. But you're right, it did have the success of helping me get to Prague and to meet my future wife, Zdenka, as well as the Oscar.
Yeah, and I find, you know, it's funny because I found another story that you related to your Tom and Jerry work that you produced in Prague as a very, it's a great side story. You mentioned that to avoid an obvious Czechoslovakian connection during the credits for the episodes, when they were shown in the U.S., you actually had to Americanize the names of the Czech studio team members, which I know probably was kind of sad for you.
This is a sort of bitter memory, but it's part of the reality of the world. Don't forget, this was a time when this country was Czechoslovakia, and it was a communist state. Bill Snyder was afraid the films produced here might be hard to market, so he insisted that Czech animators' names on the screen credits be changed to seem like American names. Those were dark and difficult times. It saddened me that these hardworking and talented people had not only lost their freedom, but even their names.
Yeah, that is kind of sad, really, when you think about it. It's now you mentioned as one of the biggest things that happened to you in your career was the arrival of Morton Schindel of Weston Woods in Prague and the relationship that came from that. So, are you still working together today, or?
Yeah, you know, this also reminds me of something that I didn't plan to talk about, but while I was still at Terrytoons, Morton Schindel called in one day that he wanted to see me. He called to my secretary and wanted to see me. And I, you know, I tried to see people as much as I could. And he showed up at the studio and he had in his sweaty palm about six little 16-millimeter films that he had made at home, more or less, basically handing all the illustrations in the book, no animation, whatever, and with a very nice narration and very sweet music, and they were little itty-bitty children's stories. And look, we were CBS Terrytoons, we were doing 20th Century Fox Cinemascope cartoons, I was developing Tom Terrific, and this kind of stuff, I thought, well, this was just something we just couldn't get involved in. But the fact that we were working on Tom Terrific, we were being pressured by the Bob Keeshan office. Bob Keeshan was Captain Kangaroo, to get the Tom Terrific films as soon as possible onto the air. As I mentioned before, we had a six-month deadline, and we were still several months away from being able to deliver anything. So I thought, just on the off chance that was the only program in the world I could think of that might be able to use Morton Schindel's little simple children's cartoons. So I sent Mort Schindel to the Captain Kangaroo office, and they actually took his film and put them on the air. And that time it was probably the only possible market for those films. And Mort didn't have anything at that time, and it was a great success for him. And so it worked out really perfectly because, God, I don't know how many years later this I'm talking now about 1957, I think, and in 1968, Mort Schindel showed up in Prague, and in the meantime, with his start that he had on the Captain Kangaroo show, he had built a Weston Woods company, and he was now wealthy enough and had enough of a market that he thought he was ready to make animation, and he remembered that I gave him his first chance. You know, it was just an offhand thing. I didn't really think about it at the time. And so he came to me and he said, "You're the guy I want to do the animation for Weston Woods Films." And that has led to a 40-year relationship. So yes, Morton Schindel is still my friend. He's now in his 90s. And after 40 years and counting, I'm still directing films for Weston Woods. But Mort and I are still close friends, as I said. But about 10 years ago, he sold Weston Woods to Scholastic Publishers. However, Weston Woods continues to function as an independent unit within Scholastic, with the same basic people as producers who had worked with Mort. I'm really still the most comfortable and free to do my best work with Weston Woods, as long as Paul Gagné, the longtime producer with Mort, continues to assign projects to me, and as long as I'm healthy enough to do them, I'll be happy to carry on with them.
That's great. That's great. That's a great story, too. And that, again, further proves how just you never know when you have a relationship or, yeah. You know, it's so funny how things evolve.
Yeah. I just remembered that story. Yeah, so, well, it's really become my life thing to adapt children's picture books. I'm always in the background. It isn't so great for putting my name forward, but it's fulfilling work and it's valuable work.
Yeah.
And if you want to know about other things that I'm doing, I think if you want to go to my website, you can see many of the things that have been occupying me all through the years. Perhaps most notably that my longtime interest in traditional American jazz and country music, as well as technology, led me to become an early home recording enthusiast. I got a disc recorder right after the war. I think in 1945 I had my first recorder, and I went through wire recorders and tape recorders and all the way up to mini disc recorders. And on my website, GeneDeitch.com, you'll see that over the years I've made private recordings with Pete Seeger, John Lee Hooker, and a completely unknown singer and composer, Connie Converse. The recordings of that amazing woman, which I made nearly 60 years ago, have now been restored and issued on a beautiful CD. Now, her story is really amazing and dramatic. I'd like to have people read it. You can read all about it and hear some of it on links from my www.GeneDeitch.com.
That's excellent. And by the way, just kind of, I guess this is going off a little bit off topic, but I happened to catch, I guess it was WNYC.org, David Garland's talking, it's called Spinning on the Air, talking about, I want to say Elizabeth, but it's Connie Converse. In her career, what a story! I was like,
yes, well, that's it. I mentioned Connie Converse just now offhand way because I didn't know how much of a story you wanted to get into, but it was really funny that once on a trip to New York, Dave Garland heard that I was in New York, and he got the idea that he would put father and son together on one show playing their favorite records. He had this show called Spinning on Air on WNYC. And so this was the thing, and he wanted to show the kind of music we collected. Well, look, I was collecting, as always, traditional New Orleans jazz records, and I put together a CD full of all of my favorites. And while I was doing it, it suddenly popped into my head that here was a chance to get at least one Connie Converse song on the air. And I just, it didn't fit in with anything else I was playing. But I just said, "Well, Dave, here's something you just might want to hear. It isn't exactly on my kind of thing or on my regular program of records that I've brought." And I played one song of hers. It was called One by One, which was my favorite song that she composed and sang. And it got some nice comments, but nothing much happened. But 3 years later, a guy named Daniel Zula, who was an executive at a recording studio downtown Manhattan, he sent me an email and he said, "I heard your program 3 years ago, and this song has been buzzing in my head ever since, and I want to know more about it." So I sent him a copy of my whole repertoire of songs I had recorded from Connie, and that is the beginning of a really fantastic story, and it's been all over the news and the New Yorker and everything else. So there again, that, you can, if you go to my website, GeneDeitch.com, there's a link to the entire Connie Converse story. It's unbelievable, really unbelievable.
It is, because I didn't, you know, I started listening to it, I thought, well, yeah, you know, now I'm not going to say she was the absolute best singer, but something about her music was really... I wanted to keep listening. Yeah. I said, okay, I'm going to listen more and more and more. And then you hear the story behind it, her life. I'm like, how sad, you know?
Well, that's what my wife, Venka, has the same reaction, you know, because she's critical of her because she says, well, she's singing falsely or something. But there is, when you really listen to her songs, you find out quite quickly that they're really all about her. She's a woman who was not beautiful. She looked like she could have been a nun.
Yes.
But she was. She had some internal passion, and her life was full of disappointments and unrequited love. I guess that's it. And she just never made it sexually. And it all comes out in her song. Oh, listen to these songs, you know, your heart breaks. It's amazing. I don't want hear too much about it because everyone seems to have the same reaction that you've just stated.
Yeah, well, they should go to your site and check it out. And by the way, I purchased the John Lee Hooker CD that you actually recorded. So it's
another
great.
Another amazing story. Yeah. Those are the things that really had nothing to do with my work necessarily, but which have turned out to have great meaning to me, and things that have just sort of sat in the dark in somewhere in my cellar or something and come out 50, 60 years later and suddenly become something. So it is really quite fulfilling. Yeah. Look, I can't complain about anything.
No, it sounds great. And I guess I just need to wrap it up and just say thank you so much for your time here. And I know how busy you are and still currently, you know, working. So I really want to personally thank you for Tom Terrific, really, because that really had such a positive impact on my childhood. And it really means a lot to me to be able to talk to you.
That's so good. Well, I'm, you know, 90% of my fan mail is about Tom Terrific, and there's so many people of the so-called baby boomers who had the same feeling you had, and it's pretty fulfilling to me. As I said, I've done a lot of bigger, big-time things, but that's the thing that everyone remembers me about, and it has really turned out to be Gene Deitch's greatest hit.
Well,
it's been a great pleasure talking to you, Todd, and I hope that you'll send me a copy of this and be sure you edit out all the dirty language and so on.
I sure will. And
okay.
Thanks a lot, Gene. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the time with Gene as much as I did, and perhaps you may have even learned something amongst all these wonderful stories. Hey, I've got to run, folks. It's been great. I hope you enjoy these interviews as much as I do conducting them. Be sure to check out the supporting site to this podcast at behindthelines.blogspot.com. Of course, there's a link directly from this podcast to that one. It's been great, folks. I've got to run. So long. I will see you next time on the Boing Podcast. Take care. So long.
song to my mom and dad. They're here tonight. Dad taught me how to play guitar.
I see trees that are green, red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, oh, what a wonderful world. The color rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of the people passing by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, "How do you do?" But then to myself.
Thank you so much for coming. You've been really wonderful. Thank you.
Peter Cassidy.
Thank you.